Be kind to me.
When your boss says be kind to you as you're sitting down. Well, thank you, Bessa, for the introduction. And hello to the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia and my boss, Michelle. So thank you for joining us on this, the ABE's Night of Nights, the annual dinner. So I think it's probably fair to say that in the course of our engagement at work, it's usually you asking me the questions, like what's going on in that data, why are your forecasts wrong, that sort of stuff. Tonight the shoe is on the other foot. I have to say I feel dizzy with the power. Actually, you've got no cause for concern, Michelle, because I only have two objectives tonight. One is for us to have an interesting and engaging conversation for our membership. And the second one is to make sure I still have a job tomorrow. So I think our incentives are aligned. So we might kick off then. So you've recently just passed the two-year mark in your role as the governor of the RBA. So this is a two-part question. So in those 2 years as governor, what have been the most rewarding parts, other than working with me, and what have been the most challenging parts, other than working with me?
So 2 years, it's hard to believe. That's absolutely flown. And I'd have to say up front that I'm very honoured to hold this position and very humbled by holding this position. I actually work with great people, including yourself. So I'm very, very fortunate to have the job that I do. And I get to meet a lot of really interesting people. So I think, you know, it's I feel very, very privileged and very, very honoured by that. What's been some of the fun things, the amazing things? I think there's been a few things. I'm really happy with the way that we have managed to get inflation under control. So a lot of the heavy lifting, of course, was done by my predecessor as the chair, but I took over in September, and then we did raise interest rates one more time with me as chair before we sat for some time. But I'd have to say that what we've managed to achieve, you know, I don't want to count my chickens too soon, but what we've managed to achieve in bringing inflation back down and managing to maintain some of the gains in the labour market, for me, has been a very satisfying outcome. I'd have to say that was probably the challenge as well. Inflation was peaked at 7.8%. I think when I came in, it was 6%. So the challenge of getting it down, I think, was... it was we were never 100% sure. We were very cautious, and I've said this before, but it was a very deliberate strategy of the Reserve Bank Board to try and bring inflation back down to target in a measured way. It was a very deliberate strategy. It was a very deliberate strategy to try and maintain the gains we had in employment, because you might recall that many countries, including Canada, New Zealand, the US, the UK, Sweden, their interest rates went much higher than ours, in some cases above 5%. And we were under a lot of pressure from some commentators to actually increase interest rates much further than we did. But we did stick with our guns, and interestingly, our labour market outcomes have been much better than some other countries, particularly Canada and New Zealand, I think. So I think that's been a really satisfying part of the job. I'd have to say the challenge... And the other thing I've found really satisfying is the way that my team, the Reserve Bank team, has lent into change in the organisation. So we've had a couple of reviews, we've had a lot of change going on, and I've just been so... blown away by the way the teams have lent into the change. They've tried really hard, and I think we are making some real progress on the culture in the organisation. On the challenges, interestingly, the things that probably keep me awake at night, the challenges, are not the monetary policy ones. They're the things like a certain 65 Martin Place building, which is riddled with asbestos. And as many of you know, what started as a renovation project has become a development now. I'm not a developer. None of my staff are developers. So we've got, you know, this is a really, really challenging situation. And I'm very, very conscious that I need to be getting advice from people who know what they're doing in this stuff. So that's sort of I find challenging. The other thing is that many people don't realise that we do much more than just set interest rates. We do government banking, we run a very important payment system, we distribute banknotes, we have big operational needs, and we have a massive IT, just like commercial banks, we have a massive IT operation. And some of the challenges for me are how we keep our cyber defences up, how we keep our operational resilience up. We've had some reasonably challenging outages, which... So I think that those... Ironically, those are the sorts of things I think that I've felt most challenged by in this role. How do I... I'm an economist. How do I actually deal with these very operational parts of the organisation? And partly it's surrounding myself with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a good answer. Yeah, and having spent a couple of years myself in... as an economist, but in the other parts of the bank, it's fascinating, and we really do cover a very broad range of things inside our building. So you've mentioned the review, and it's now been about 2.5 years, I think, since the review was published. Yeah. Now, there's been lots of changes. Lots of those changes have been very well publicised, and people in this room will know about them. But what do you think have been some of the more significant changes that might be less visible to people from outside the institution?
So there are visible changes that you will have all noticed. So there was the move to 8 meetings a year. There was the press conferences after every meeting. We've started publishing much more detail on our forecasts and our estimates of spare capacity, things like that. They're all things that the review asked us to do. But internally, there's been, I'd say there's probably a couple of key changes. The first thing is we have overhauled, really, our processes leading up to board meetings. So from the very start of the process up until the press conference finishes, that whole process now has undergone quite a bit of change. And it's been changed in a way to try and get as much diverse opinion in to the process as early as possible, so that we're not making up our mind close to the board meeting. We've had internal discussions which have been debates, discussions, and so we've overhauled all of that, and I think that's been really positive. It means that by the time we get to the board meeting, we have really gone the rounds on all the possibilities that we possibly could think of for the board. So that's sort of the what. So there's sort of different sorts of meetings than we used to have. They're occurring earlier. They have much more input from different sorts of people, more junior people. All of the policy areas have an opportunity to contribute to the discussion. So I think that's really positive. The second change is something that the review called out, and I'm looking at Luke because he was sort of involved, Luke Yeaman. It was our culture, and what the review called out was that we tended to have a culture of perhaps people not saying what they thought, but perhaps just saying what the boss wanted to hear, what they thought the boss wanted to hear. And so we've put a lot of effort into trying to have an open and what we call an open and dynamic culture in the organisation, open to ideas, open to diverse opinions, and dynamic in the sense of trying new things. And now there's some things that you don't want to mess with. You don't want to mess with the payment system, RITS. You don't want to try experimenting there. That's very important, that's stable. But in other areas, can we try things and do things differently? And does it matter if we try something and it doesn't work? So we've tried to introduce a culture that is much more encouraging of that, respectful challenge, respectful, diverse. People should feel free to express a different opinion, and they should understand that they're being listened to. So, you know, I often used to say to people that just because I don't end up agreeing with you doesn't mean I didn't listen to you. I think it's really important we listen and we understand where people are coming from. So that's a cultural change. I think we're still partway through it. I don't think it's all the way there yet, but I'm encouraged by the feedback I'm getting that people do feel that they can speak up more. They do feel they have been listened to, and I think we get better decisions and better discussion when people feel they can do that.
Yeah, see, here. I agree with that. You know, I've been at the RBA quite a long time as well. And I think, you know, there's always been challenge in the building, but it feels like now it's almost become like really like an agenda item. You know, it's like, well, where could I be wrong here? Like, where could we be wrong in thinking about this? And you know, I think that's great for the institution. But you've talked a little bit reference to the economy before, so let's maybe have a little bit of a chat about the international side of things before we turn to the domestic economy. So you've just come back from Washington, D.C. for the IMF annual meetings, the G20 meetings. When I was there in my time in the New York office, I got to experience that. It's a buzz. There's a lot goes on. You are very busy. You speak to a lot of people. So we just thought, you know, a lot of that stuff is, you know, their meetings, you know, not on the record, that sort of thing. You're talking to a lot of your central bank peers. Just wondering if you could maybe share with us some of the common themes to emerge from your discussions while you're at those meetings, and then possibly where there are any areas or issues where the Australian perspective is a bit different.
So there's a few sort of topic areas. I mean, inflation and unemployment was one sort of area where, particularly with my peers from other central banks, we often were discussing how's it all going. And I'd have to say that generally on the inflation front, most central banks seem pretty comfortable that inflation is coming back down. Common with ourselves and many other is stickiness in service inflation, and many countries are experiencing this. So even though they're seeing inflation start to come back down towards their targets, they're still seeing services inflation as being a bit sticky. I think many of them feel that the spare capacity that's being induced by the fact that interest rates were higher is going to continue to bring that inflation down. But some of them have experienced, unlike us, so the area where we are different, and I alluded to this earlier, some of them are experiencing higher unemployment rates. So some of them have seen the higher interest rates actually start to impact their... So some of them have got unemployment rates above 6% now. So that is great. The US is not in that camp. The US has done astoundingly well and continues to do quite well considering everything that's going on there. So there was a lot of talk amongst central banks, I suppose, about inflation and unemployment. The other topic that sort of came up a bit as well was a little bit of head-scratching about the markets. Why are the markets so sanguine about what's going on in the world economy? Not just in the world economy, but also with all the geopolitical tension out there as well. And people are scratching their heads. People are thinking, well, you know, could it all end up very badly? So there's sort of no answers there, but people are just a little bit flummoxed about why there's, you know, credit spreads are really low, the risk premium are really low. What is it that the markets are so comfortable about? They just think that there's going to be no bad outcomes here. And I think some people are worried that might all end in tears. The third topic probably that popped up a lot was deficits and government debt, particularly in the context of Europe and the United States. We're a bit different there again because we We have got relatively low, compared with many other countries, relatively low debt to GDP ratios. Our deficits aren't. We've had a couple of surpluses, and the most recent deficit, in fact, is very quite small as well. So we're in a slightly different space than some of them, because some of the European countries, in particular, and they're seeing pressure to spend more on defence. So there's all of that. So that sort of topic also was a theme. And then finally, there was sort of a grab bag of financial stability sort of themes. So there is a bit of a push in the US on the regulation side. So I think they're looking, I think, for ways to... I think people sort of refer to it as making regulation more efficient. The UK is looking at it. I think Europe's looking at it as well. The US is making a very big push in this direction. So I think there was, in some quarters, a little bit of concern that they didn't want to see, for example, Basel III watered down. They wanted to make sure that Basel III was implemented because it still hasn't been fully implemented. So there was that little sort of worry. But then there's this whole sort of series of things, stable coins and what might that mean for financial stability. I think there's a variety of views. On the one hand, some people think that it actually has got no financial stability implications at all. It's nothing to see here. And then there's others who are a little bit worried that if they grow a lot and they are quite heavily involved in government debt markets and debt markets generally, then there might be potential problems there. So they're sort of some of the broad themes, I think, that people were sort of thinking about.
So we might actually turn then to the domestic economy. So, and actually let's get to the here and now, focus on some recent data. So the unemployment rate in the month of September, up to 4.5%. And then we've seen some of the detail in a couple of the recent monthly CPI indicator prints pointing to possibly inflation being stronger than expected than me and my team expected in the September quarter. So, yes, unemployment a bit higher than expected, but inflation also a little bit higher than expected. What do you make of all that?
Yes, well... So, first of all, I guess I'd say monthly numbers can be volatile, and the jump up in the unemployment rate was a bit of a surprise, as you said, that it jumped so much. But monthly numbers can be volatile. And we do know sometimes that they jump up and then they jump back down again. So I don't want to leap at a single number. I'm conscious also that, and I made this point at the previous press conference about the inflation numbers, that the monthly inflation numbers are also very volatile. And I should say that when we get the full monthly CPI in November for October, I think it is, isn't it? Monthly numbers are going to be more volatile, even though it's going to be a full CPI and not an indicator anymore, it's still going to be volatile. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a little bit of interesting information in there. And as we highlighted at the time, what we'd seen from a couple of monthly indicators was dwelling costs and market services both looked a little elevated. So that was sort of a bit of an alert for us. So on the one hand, we've got unemployment a little bit higher. On the other hand, we've got inflation a little bit higher. So I think really the way... the board is thinking about this is, I think they've used the word cautious before. The board, as I said earlier, we didn't go up as high as other countries. So it might mean we don't have to come down quite as far as other countries. I often get asked where we think neutral is and the neutral interest rate is. And we don't really know. We think we're still a little bit restrictive. We think the neutral rate's probably a little bit below this. We still think we're a little bit restrictive. So we think that it's still, when we look at the forward-looking indicators for the labour market, that doesn't appear in the medium term to be suggesting that the unemployment rate's going to deteriorate quite markedly. So we'd always thought that it would drift up a bit. Maybe it's drifted up a bit further than we thought, but it's not a huge amount out. So I think We just have to wait. We just have to wait for a bit more data. You know, we've got a board meeting coming up next week. We will have a new set of forecasts along with that. The forecasts are based on, you know, our models, our judgments about the way relationships work between the various variables in the economy. And so we'll do our best guess at what we think. We know we sort of where we were at the end of June. What do we think we're going to be looking at moving into the next 6 months? And on that basis, we can make some decisions about whether or not there's some more interest rate cuts in the to address perhaps the employment market, or whether we're a little bit more worried about the inflation rate. But let's be you know, positive in a sense. Inflation is back in the band. It's not down at the midpoint of the target range, which is where we're supposed to be aiming, but it is back in the band. And the unemployment rate is still pretty low compared with where it was pre-COVID. So I still think we're in a pretty good position.
I just don't say that too loudly, all right? Where's some wood we can touch, right? As central bankers, we worry. We always worry. There has been some remarks made about the RBA being backward-looking in terms of our steadying policy. Yeah? What are your thoughts on that?
So I don't know whether or not this sort of idea that we're backward-looking comes from the concept that we talk about ourselves as data-driven. We're not saying that. We're only looking at past data and making decisions based on that. We have to be forward-looking, and we're forward-looking in a number of ways. We use the data that we've got to say, well, this is how we knew we were in, say, June of this year or September of this year. We know where we were then. What do our models tell us about how the economy will respond? What sort of forward-looking indicators do we have? And there are forward-looking indicators. We have surveys. We have, as I mentioned earlier, some forward-looking indicators of the labour market, vacancies, quit rates, those sorts of things. They all give us a bit of a guide on what might be happening. We have our liaison program, which is very important, and that gives us a good idea about what businesses are thinking. And I'd have to say that it's usually pretty reliable. I'm quite impressed with it's not absolutely spot on, and it doesn't give you necessarily 100% correlations with things, but it does give you a good feel for what the business community are feeling, and I think that does give us some sort of forward-looking angle. So no, I don't agree that we're backward-looking. Yes, we do take the data we've got, and we're anchored there, and we know where we were. But then we look forward, and we look forward using our forecasts, using our models, using our judgment, and using these other sorts of information we get from surveys and our liaison programs.
Yes, and as someone who's spent a long time in the RBA forecasting, I can tell you we do spend a lot of time thinking about forecasts. But I guess that, you know, we all know that forecasting accurately is difficult. And we have to be humble, so that's why we take into account a whole lot of things. I think my favourite forecasting quote ever is, forecasting is like trying to drive a car blindfolded, receiving directions from someone looking out the back window. You think about that, it's not actually that far off from the truth, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, there's many people around the room here who do forecasting too, and you have to be humble. I mean, you do your best. Things don't always turn out as you forecast, but you have to be ready to accept that you might have misread something and change your mind. You do have to be ready to do that.
Absolutely. So we're going to have some time shortly for we've got some media present, as well as of course our ABE members, to ask some questions. But before we get to those, I've got some questions for you, and I can honestly say Michelle has not seen these questions. These are five getting to know Michelle Bullock questions. Quick response. Let's see how we go. All right. All right. So I've seen you weave your magic on the touch football field on numerous occasions over the years. So remembering there are no right or wrong answers to these questions, what's your favourite footy code?
Rugby.
Rugby, which
Union.
One?
Union.
Incorrect. Rugby, okay, fair enough. Okay, this one, I think I know the answer to this one, but it's an important question for many people. Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Okay. Yeah, there was no. What's your go-to karaoke song?
It's Kiki D and Elton John, Don't Go Breaking My Heart.
If I only knew that beforehand, we could have that up here. That would have been great. Hey, next time. All right. So what's one thing, maybe a hobby or an interest, that you'd like to spend more time doing? And I'm sure you've got plenty of spare time as governor, but... Yeah.
I'd like to spend a bit more time playing the guitar. I taught myself to play guitar during COVID, and ever since I've just not had enough time to do it. So I'd like to get back to that.
Yeah, me too. Maybe we should jam. All right, last one. Yes. Quite recently, you became a grandmother for the first time, so congratulations. Now, which do you prefer, being a mother or a grandmother? Now, before you answer that, I just want to know, your granddaughter is obviously too young to understand this conversation, but this is on the record, so at some point she can go looking for a transcript.
This is very difficult.
Only the tough questions from you.
I'd have to say at the moment, being a grandmother. But having said that, I really did enjoy my kids growing up.
Yeah, the Bullock children are just throwing things at the screen right now, saying, how could she put the grandchildren ahead of us? So thank you so much for that. So we now have some time for our audience to ask questions. Now, the way we're going to do this logistically is, firstly, anyone can ask a question, but we've got two mics set up. So the mic over on this side of the room will be for media. So we have a media table over there. So if media want to ask a question, you can queue up behind that mic. Anyone else who would like to ask a question to the governor, there's another mic over this side of the room. So please make your way over to that mic and be ready to ask a question. Now, just a couple of things. We're going to take maybe two or three questions from our non-media guests first. But when you do ask a question from either mic, please... one question per person to give as many people the possibility to ask theirs. If you do try and sneak more than one question in, then the governor will only answer one and she'll pick which one it is. So there's your incentive to stick with one. Okay, so we have someone at the mic. So as you ask your question, could you just provide your name and affiliation, please?
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michelle Bullock. My name's Nick Geno from UBS Rate Strategy. I've got one question for each of you, so I could try and get around the rules. Michael, what is your Q3 CPI forecast for Trim Mean? And Michelle, what constitutes a material forecast miss for the board? Is it 20 basis points, or does it need to be more like 30? Thank you.
So mine one's easier to answer because all I can do is refer you to the statement on monetary policy from August and what we'd published in there and what you can back out of that. So that's all I'm going to be saying. Over to you for the other one.
I don't think the board has ever discussed what a material miss is. I think it's a little bit in the eye of the beholder, quite frankly. But if you ended up with, say, 30 basis point, That for me would be a reasonably material miss. So our forecast for was 0.6, I think, wasn't it, for September quarter? Yeah, in the August statement on monetary policy. And so if it came in at a 0.9, I think that would be quite a material miss.
And sometimes as well, the devil's in the detail too. You've got to understand what drove the miss. As well, which is really important. And that's a very unhelpful answer for now, but it does matter. Tapas.
Hello. Hello, Governor. Good evening. I was just wondering, your comments on stickiness in service inflation, particularly when you're discussing it globally at the recent IMF meetings, I was wondering if there was any common thought of what was driving that stickiness in services inflation and whether that is possibly related to saving the gains in the labour market. And perhaps maybe the labour market is just a little bit too tight and that's generating some of that stickiness of inflation. Thank you.
I think overseas, I think there's a feeling in some of the economies that do have sticky services inflation that it is related a little bit to wages and labour market, although, as I said earlier, some of those countries think that actually the slack in the labour market is going to bring that down. So you're seeing countries like the UK, even though they've got a little bit elevated services inflation, they're continuing to sort of lower their interest rates because they do think it's going to come through on that. In our case, I think it's worth noting that unit labour costs are still growing by about 5%. So that is something that I think is possibly holding up services inflation. It's also possible, though, that there are just some idiosyncratic things going on with services inflation. Certainly, I think we observed in some of the monthly CPI indicators that takeout and restaurant meals were sort of still a bit elevated. That could be grocery prices. It could be sort of food that's driving a little bit of that. It could also be that there's still, as we said, just a little bit of tightness left in the labour market. And we do, I know not everyone agrees with this, but our judgment is that there still is a little bit of tightness in the labour market. So that, I think, is one reason why we might be observing services inflation hold up.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll take one more from this mic and then go to the media.
Damien Bowie, Wilson Asset Management. Michelle, before you mentioned, I guess, what you were hearing from central bankers abroad with financial markets and being too sanguine and things like that, you've also mentioned that I guess we all learn in the forecasting business from where we got it right or wrong and the surprises. In light of all of that, how are you and the bank currently thinking about uncertainty? Because we've mentioned it a lot and we've had a number of episodes of uncertainty, but yet markets and the global economy have been remarkably resilient to that.
So there's a couple of ways where we're thinking about and dealing with uncertainty. The first point, I think, with uncertainty, and I'd have to say unpredictability as well, which is not quite the same thing in my mind anyway, they're a bit different. What we've been thinking about is what that might mean for consumers and businesses' spending plans. So it's quite possible that uncertainty will put businesses off investment. So certainly in overseas, I think there's a concern that it doesn't seem to have eventuated yet, but there is some concern that businesses are holding off a bit on investment. We haven't seen that so much in Australia, and we haven't really seen either consumers or businesses in Australia reacting really to this uncertainty overseas. So we haven't really been... So we're looking at it, what it might mean for overseas, but we're not really seeing it show up here first. The way we are dealing with uncertainty in the forecast surrounding that is we are doing a lot more scenario analysis. So we are looking at... And this is sort of... I mentioned earlier about some of the things we're doing differently internally that you might necessarily notice. We're investing more in scenario analysis. We're doing more on alternative rate paths and what that might mean for our forecasts. So we're trying to look at, if we are wrong, what direction might it be and what might the implications be if we are wrong in that direction. So that's sort of the way we're trying to handle the uncertainty associated with what's going on.
Thank you.
Have we got any question from the media, Mike, over there? Thank you.
Hello. Luke Kinsella from the Financial Review. Governor, the RBA noted in its last meeting that equity risk premia are close to a multi-decade low. Are you concerned that the RBA has cut rates and will likely continue to cut rates at the same time when people are seriously considering the possibility of an AI bubble?
Well, we're not aiming at asset prices. The worry on the asset price side of things, as I alluded to earlier, is that if markets all of a sudden decide that things are not as rosy as they thought, it might have financial stability implications. It might mean that financial conditions tighten quite a lot, and that's actually bad for the economy. So if you had those sort of circumstances, you might be looking at central banks around the world and possibly even us lowering interest rates further in the face of potential tightening in financial conditions if those things unwound. But we're not looking at asset prices. We're looking at those to get a sense for financial conditions, but we're not aiming at those sorts of things. We're very focused, obviously, on inflation and employment. What we're really interested in the context of the asset markets is what it might mean for financial stability and what that ultimately might mean for financial conditions if the markets take a very big directional shift.
Okay, back over to the other mic. Sherelle.
Thanks, Mike. Hello, Governor. Good to hear you feeling a bit better. I just wanted to ask you about perhaps extending on the answer 2 ago about the impact of the tariffs and the trade war. We've done some work which suggests that actually it might be positive for the Australian economy, mainly through the terms of trade effect, in the sense that we're getting lower import prices and potentially we're getting more investment. Is that something that you've considered? We've done a bit of anecdotal kind of work around this, talking to many clients, and it doesn't seem that there's many clients negatively affected. In fact, some seem to be finding export opportunities that they didn't have before. Is this the sort of thinking that you've also been doing at the RBA?
Yeah, we have been thinking about it. I think our feeling is, for the reasons you talked about, that if anything, what's going on will potentially be deflationary for Australia for the reasons you highlighted. One might be trade diversion. It might be that the effect on the terms of trade, if China slows, for example, quite a lot as a result, then the effect on the terms of trade. Of course, the exchange rate also helps us here, so it would, to some extent, help buffer us. In fact, you'll recall back in April when the tariffs were announced, the Australian dollar took a massive dive. So the dollar does sort of help buffer us. But I think our feeling generally has been, provided it's not a really extreme trade outcome, that we're not really going to be heavily affected. And if anything, it might help the deflationary process a little bit for us. So, you know, there's also questions about whether or not there might be investment opportunities here. If people are sort of a bit uncertain about investment elsewhere, maybe they'll think about Australia as a sort of a reasonably settled and calm country at the moment. So there might be some other positive impacts. So we've sort of tried to capture some of this in our not only our central forecast, but also when we've done some scenario analysis, we've tried to look at what those sorts of things might mean for Australia.
Now back to our media friends.
Thank you both. Governor, I just wanted to ask, as you mentioned, one thing you've been really proud of is keeping the gains in the labour market post-pandemic. But you don't sound that concerned by the monthly rise in unemployment, which is partially the result of some of that momentum coming out of the pandemic being lost. You know, we were having 30,000 plus jobs being created on net each month for 3 years, and now that's down to something like less than 8% through the last 6 months. Less than 8,000 jobs. Are you ready to let that momentum go, that post-pandemic momentum go? Should we get used to less momentum in the jobs market?
Sorry, I missed that last part of the question there.
Should we just get used to having less momentum in the jobs market?
You highlight the point, which I think is important, that there are still jobs being created, just not as many. And that's partly, I think, reflects the fact that and this is a lag, of course. What we're seeing in the jobs market now is sort of reflecting what activity sort of has been doing for some time. It's not sort of instantaneous. So we did see slowish growth in GDP through this period, and I think we are seeing the gap in As I said, we think that the labour market's still a little bit tight. So this is bringing the labour market back more to balance. But the labour market, there's still employment being created. The other thing to remember here is that we think the supply of labour isn't growing as quickly as it was. So even though employment isn't growing as quickly, the supply of labour is not growing as quickly either. So that means that the unemployment rate might rise a bit, but it wouldn't necessarily rise by as much as you might expect if we were still seeing lots and lots of supply of labour coming into the... and then, as I said earlier, if you look at things like vacancy rates, quits rates, voluntary separations, those sorts of things, pardon me, they don't suggest, and our liaison with business, when we talk to the businesses, there's a large chunk, maybe half the businesses we talk to, who say they still find it a little bit difficult to get labour, to get the right skilled labour. So there's still signs out there that the labour market's a little bit tight and that it's not actually going to all of a sudden fall off a cliff. So I think we're watching it. We are conscious that we want to try and keep the unemployment rate as low as we can without fueling inflation. And how close are we to that? We think we're close-ish, but it's very uncertain. So we've got to be prepared to consider different possibilities, and if it looks like we're wrong on that, then we have to be prepared to change our mind and move.
Thank you. Over to our other mic.
Yes, hi, Governor. Michael Potter from the Commonwealth Bank, and I have got a question on payments for you. So on Friday, the Reserve Bank, you announced that you were going to take longer to be doing your review of retail payments. Separately, you're going to be getting powers quite shortly that are expanded your options in retail payments. Are you going to be conducting two reviews? Are you going to be continuing with the existing review and then do a separate bit of work under your new powers, or are you going to be bringing them together and having one review that covers both your existing powers and your new powers? Thank you.
We've got a payment system board meeting coming up in November, so I don't know what the board will decide. The powers don't come in until December, the new powers. I think the way that we're thinking about it at this stage is that if there are some reforms we can make, that will be no regrets reforms that we can do without actually having to use the new powers, then we would look probably to try and do them. I think the main issue here is that if we waited to get the powers and we did a whole new review, we're going to be looking at a very long period of time. So, again, I think what we'll be looking to do is, are there things we can do now that we won't regret doing, even when we're looking at using our new powers in the future?
Back to the media.
Thank you very much. Governor Bullock, Michael, thank you for the wonderful event. My name is Matt Johnson. I'm not actually media. I'm from Coolabah Capital, but I was sitting at table 13. It was a long way to walk, so I hope you don't mind. I'd like to give you each a chance to talk a little bit about the Nehru. We've kind of been talking around it a bit, and I wanted to pick up on something you said just now in the previous answer, Governor Bullock. Talking about how, you know, there's still a little bit of tightness in the labour market, and just if you could talk a little bit about the Nehru, maybe a little bit about the potentially higher inflation number. And I know you get a lot of advice, the Nehru is lower, the Nehru is higher. Michael, maybe you can fill us in with how the banks, I read the FOIs, but you know, I'm not a doctor of economics, so maybe I'm not across all the detail, but maybe you could colour in a little, you know, if we were to get a higher unemployment rate and a higher inflation print at the same time, does that mean the Nehru is maybe a bit higher, or how would you think about that sort of logic? Thanks very much.
So a couple of points up front. The Nehru is an uncertain concept. We don't know what it is. It's a sort of a theoretical concept. And I always like to point out to people that we don't just sort of fixate on a number the Nauru, and that's it. We are looking at a whole plethora of labour market indicators to give us an idea about what's going on in the labour market. Why I worry about the Nauru and everyone's sort of obsession with the Nauru is that it gets reported as the Reserve Bank is aiming for an unemployment rate of X. We are not aiming for that. So that's why I get a little bit concerned, and I try to suggest to people don't get too fixated on a number for the Nauru. Having said that, what we can't observe it, but what we can observe is inflation and wages. So, and unit labour costs. So we can observe these things, and they give us an indication of whether or not we think the labour market is still a little bit on the tight side or a little bit on the loose side. So if for example, we saw no more disinflation and inflation started to rise again, and we saw perhaps wages picking up, then that might suggest to you that the unemployment rate is currently below the Nauru, if you like. But again, I caution against just sort of fixating on one single number because I don't think it's very helpful.
Thank you very much. Rob Torben from Equities at UBS. I guess having started a career in the 80s, you used to deal with enormous lags in data and very limited information. You know, it's interesting sitting on an equities desk at the moment, the speed of the data, the enhancement that AI and technology has given. I'm just interested in sort of your journey and what perhaps excites you in some of the data sources and the speed of it that you see in your role.
Well, I can tell you that I'm not the person sitting at the computer dealing with the numbers. I've got lots of people who do that for me. I think what's exciting, and this sort of started a little bit when COVID came in and everyone was grasping around for data. It turns out there's lots of data out there. Lots of companies have data. The government has lots of data. So I think what quite excites me is that with technology and all these new data techniques, that hopefully we're going to find a cost-effective way of harnessing the government data, the commercial data that comes from businesses. I mean, you already see this with the ABS, for example, and CPI. They now can scrape data and do all sorts of things to get actual data much more quickly and much more timely. So, and then I think the other thing is that we can look in an anonymous way to marry some of the individual data. So you've got quite granular data, and being able to use those granular data and marry them with different sorts of data sets, I think is really potentially quite exciting. So you've got granular data, for example, from the tax office, and you've got some granular data from, Commonwealth Bank. Maybe there's a way of marrying up some of these data in an anonymous way to give you insights that you might not otherwise get. So I think that's sort of the exciting thing about it.
That's a good question. We have lots of people who are, you know, love micro data and are interested in using the micro data to answer the macro questions. I think just reflecting on that as well, back to when I joined the bank back in, then the liaison program started. I think the bank's liaison program, we used to think about that as, yeah, the data were pretty infrequent. You think, you know, quarterly GDP, quarterly CPI, and the liaison was a really good way of sort of supplementing that information and like trying to fill in the gaps. And so over time now, we've got sort of the opposite. We've got so much data. I actually find a liaison is really helpful for sort of trying to sort through all the various messages that you might get from different sources of data. So the way it interacts with our liaison program is a little bit different as well, I think. Back to the media, Mike? Or
also non-media. Okay. Adam Donaldson, agree with Matt, it's a long way to walk, from Commonwealth Bank. You brought it up, so I'm going to ask an obligatory question about the neutral rate, which you said policy is perhaps marginally restrictive. It seems to me that over the past year, when we decipher the various charts and information you provide, that the number has moved around quite a lot. I think 3.5 to 2.7, maybe 3.1 at the moment on a chart in the last week or two, which seems a lot of variability for, despite the vagueness, a fairly important concept. Is it the data that is moving and causing those changes in what you're publishing, or is it different interpretations, tweaks to the models? On sort of part A, I know the two-question limit, but clearly there's also a trend where it appears to be rising through those various iterations. So whether you have any comment about where that neutral rate fits in terms of the structure of markets and how it appears to be rising, as well as the volatility in the estimates.
So you're right. We have, I think we have about seven models, different models of the neutral rate. Some are structural, more structural models. Some are more sort of econometric, sort of autoregressive style models. And they give a big range, anywhere between 1 and 3, I think, and that's just the central estimates. That doesn't include their bands of error. So it's very wide. I think if you look at the neutral rate over time, I think generally it was falling prior to COVID, not just in Australia, around the world, because ultimately, you know, you can sort of have a slightly different neutral rate, but it's heavily influenced by what's going on around the world as well. And what we've observed, I think, and we've observed this in other countries as well, the US, is that since COVID, it's been rising again. So it has turned. Now, how do we? I wouldn't say we use it in any sense in a sort of a. We don't sort of sit around as a board and say, well, where's the neutral rate and where's our rate, and you know, we've got to get to here. It's too nebulous for that. But again, I'd come back to the Nauru point. It's all of the financial conditions that tell us whether or not we think we're on the tight side or not. So that's things like we were talking about risk. So there's things like risk premia risk-free rates and those sorts of things that are telling us, well, maybe there's sort of an easier financial conditions there. We're seeing credit start to pick up again. We're seeing housing prices pick up. So maybe that's indicating that conditions were a little bit easier than they were. But still, we observe that household credit is still not rising relative to disposable income. It's just flattened out. So there are still signs that financial conditions we think are maybe biting. So I guess Chris Kent gave a speech about this week or so ago, I think, talked about how we try to think about it. And so, yes, there's a neutral rate somewhere in the background there, but really what we're trying to do is assess financial conditions more broadly, and that's telling us whether or not we look tight relative to a neutral rate or not. I'm sorry, it's not really a very firm answer, but it's a nebulous concept.
Thank you.
And just to add to that, the things that we, for the nerds amongst us, we estimate the Nauru, these unobservables, the Nauru potential output and the neutral rate. Our super nerds in the RBA, estimating the neutral rate is the hardest of those three to pin down. It's just so imprecisely estimated that it makes it very difficult to think of it as a useful policy tool. But estimating those models is sort of helpful, because maybe over time we can see, has a thing, we sort of know conceptually things that move the neutral rate. So by looking at these results, we can at least get a high-level sense, well, what are the big picture forces globally and domestically that might be moving the neutral rate? But really, we don't recommend sort of thinking about it as a short-term benchmark. So we might have our final question from this mic over here.
Sure, thank you. So Laura Fitzsimmons, Head of Macro Sales at Deutsche Bank. I'm interested to understand from yourself, Governor Bullock, and also Dr. Plum, perhaps. Firstly, also thank you for the entertaining conversation this evening. But as we head into the November meeting, a lot in the market are wondering around the external board members and the way in which they're going to vote. We have no attributed votes. We haven't heard from any of them in terms of public speeches. So it is quite difficult for the market to ascertain which way they may land on the day. I know, Governor Bullock, at the last press conference, you said that you didn't know which way they would vote, and we understand that, but what can the market do to learn more about these external members, and when are we going to hear from them after 6 months?
It was a recommendation of the review that the board members speak publicly at least once a year, and that we publish unattributed votes. We knew the minute we published unattributed votes, people would say, oh, yeah, but who voted what way? So, anyway. But the fact is we have a different system than others. And I know it's now the Monetary Policy Board, but four of those members are the same members that were on the Reserve Bank Board. And there's two new members. And so we have established a way of trying to once a year get some of the board members out there. But these board members are not like Federal Reserve governors or external members from the Bank of England that have staff that do forecasts for them, and some of them are not even academic economists. So I think it's a bit it's a little bit sort of difficult to squash our model into the sort of mould of what you're referring to, which is other countries, everyone's out there giving speeches, they're all out there attributing their votes. We've got a different system. And I think we are implementing the review in a way that still works for our particular system. Now, you will start to hear from some of the board members in various sorts of forums, but it's not necessarily going to be them standing up there giving a speech and saying, I disagreed with Michelle on XYZ. They might talk a little bit about, you know, what we're thinking as a board and so on. And they're also, I don't think, going to attribute votes. They're not going to stand up and say, I voted yay or I voted nay. So I think we do have to accept that we've got a different model here. We are trying to give a bit more transparency and around that, but there's a sort of a limit, I think, given what structure we've got at the moment, that doesn't mean we can go as far as someone like the Fed or the Bank of England or. So that would be my response.
In the interest of not finding an empty cardboard box on my desk tomorrow, I think we might let you finish up now, Michelle. You've been extremely generous with your time, and thanks so much for sharing your views with us here tonight at the ABE Annual Dinner. Put your hands together, please,
thank
for
you,
the
everyone.
Governor.